came to this just a middle stage. We have a clear sky today also, and I hope this afternoon we'll have many fun time. So let's start with the morning session. So this session is about materials. The first speaker of this session is Dr. Ed Storms. Maybe almost all people here know him, so I don't think to introduce him so much. So today's talk, he will talk about the loading and deloading behavior of Aladdin Heineken.
Well, good morning. I'm going to talk about something slightly different, but it will include that which I'm supposed to talk about. So there's a slight surprise if you're following the schedule. People who study cold fusion using electrolytic cells frequently use a catalyst in their cell to recombine the hydrogen and oxygen back to water. If you simply measure the temperature of that recombiner, you can obtain some very useful information. You can obtain the, let's go to the next, you can obtain the D:P:D ratio of the cathode very simply. You can calculate the enthalpy of formation if you use that information combined with the information from the calorimeter. And you can also identify errors that result because the recombiner that you're using doesn't function properly. And one of the things that I've discovered is that many of the recombiners that people rely on are not reliable. And therefore, you can get behaviors that challenge one's ability to understand, and hopefully you don't attribute it to LANR. These measurements are based on an electrolyte using sulfuric acid in water. The results do not depend upon the nature of the electrolyte, but sulfuric acid turns out to be a very fine electrolyte for the study of LANR if you care to use it. I'm using a CBEC calorimeter, and we'll be studying three different kinds of palladium. A commercial palladium, that's normal commercial concentration of palladium, and arc melted super pure palladium. Both of those are in the form of a sheet 1 millimeter thick, and a zone refined single crystal, which would be very, very pure and somewhat unusual. Not too many people have access to that. But let's talk about the calorimeter. The calorimeter is shown in the open condition. It consists of an aluminum box that's water cooled on all sides. And on the inside is pasted 54 thermoelectric converters, all open series. Any heat that's generated in the box, it doesn't matter where it originates, will be detected by the calorimeter. So you don't have to worry about gradients with this particular style. The design is large enough so that you can put almost anything in there. I have put in Geiger counters, for example. I've put in magnets. I have a cell that the magnets produce a magnetic field at the cathode of 2,000 Gauss. You can go higher than that with a smaller cell. I also have a cell that allows a sample to be exposed to gas, either deuterium or hydrogen, and heated up to 300 degrees, all the while measuring any excess energy to plus or minus 5 milliwatts. So this is a very fine calorimeter. It's very, very stable, and I would highly recommend if you're getting into this field that you make one like this. And I will be happy to share the design details if anybody cares to. Already three laboratories are in the process of duplicating. On the right, you see, whoops, wrong button. Got to be careful with this thing. On the right, let me do it this way. This way I won't mess it up again. This is a oil reservoir and a balance. Any gas that is generated in the cell is communicated to this oil, and that's weighed, which allows the measurement of the orphaned oxygen generated by the loading, and gives another method of determining the D to PD ratio that's independent of the value obtained from the recombiner. The cell consists of a pyrex cell around which is wrapped resistance wire that allows the temperature of the cell to be changed independent of applied electrolytic power. The cell contains 300 milliliters of electrolyte, and the calorimeter doesn't care what the cell looks like. So you can have any shape or size you care to have, and you will get the correct answer. Inside the cell is an RTD to measure the temperature of the electrolyte. This is the anode, which is platinum. Inside is the cathode attached with a plastic clamp that allows the cathode to be removed very quickly. And this is a reference electrode for measuring the open circuit voltage. The important part right here for the talk today is right here. This is the recombiner, which is a cloth of carbon on which is deposited finely divided platinum. It's very effective in recombining the gases back to water. Inside this tube is another glass-covered RTD to measure the temperature. Any gas that's generated within this cell has to pass by the recombiner to go out and go to the oil reservoir. The calibration is done by applying power to the heater, but you can put power in any form whatsoever. I've used light bulbs, I've used electrolytic technique. It doesn't matter. The source of energy in the CBEC makes no difference. So in this particular case, the calibrator is done automatically by stepping up in value until I reach the top, which is, produces a temperature of about 85 degrees. It's the highest I would wish to go. And then it goes back down in between the points that were made going up. 90 minutes is required for the calibrator to reach equilibrium. And so the first point and the last point, which superimpose here, were made about 36 hours apart. If we look at the residual, this is the difference between the point and the least squares line. You can see that the residual fluctuates in a very random way within a band of about 5 milliwatts over the entire range. It's also necessary to know the characteristics of the temperature of the recombiner. This is measured by applying electrolytic power to a platinum cathode so that there is no loss of hydrogen. All the hydrogen and oxygen now has to be recombined and produce a suitable temperature at the recombiner. This shows a rather broad range of values. This is closer to the value that I'm actually using, which is this right here, 0.1 amp, and you can see in both cases the relationship is very linear between the amount of gas that has to be recombined and the temperature that results. Two measurements are made that are important. One, of course, is the excess power based upon the calorimeter and its calibration, and the other is the recombiner temperature. These two pieces of information are the only pieces of information that are used for the purposes that I'm describing today. Now, right away, you can see that, and I should point out, too, when I turn on the electrolytic power initially after the calorimeter has reached equilibrium, I'm also applying power to the heater that is equal to the power that will be applied by electrolysis. And so when I turn on the electrolytic power, I turn off the power that I'm applying to the heater so that the calorimeter remains in equilibrium. So I can start taking data almost immediately without the calorimeter having to wait for the 90 minutes. But you can see immediately that there are three basic regions to the loading characteristics. And this basic shape is true of all materials. That only the details change. This is how palladium loads when you react it in any cell. So you notice that initially that the electrolytic power is constant, and notice that it's negative. And the reason it's negative is it requires more power to decompose the water than you get back when the hydrogen reacts with the palladium. And this is that difference. And so it's negative to start with, but you notice that it's constant. The recombiner temperature is also constant. That's saying that all the hydrogen that's being made available is going into and reacting with the palladium. But at some point, that efficiency starts to fall off, and you can see that the result is that the measured power starts to rise towards zero. The recombiner temperature starts to rise, and at some point the recombiner temperature reaches its maximum value and is constant. In this region, every single atom of hydrogen is rejected now by the palladium. That's not quite true. Some go in and come back out, so there's no net reaction taking place. And since there's no net reaction, all of the gas that is being made by electrolysis is being recombined, and so that produces the maximum temperature of the recombiner, and it produces zero for the measured excess energy. If you make such a study, this is a very good indicator to any pathological skeptic that in fact your calorimeter can in fact make accurate measurements. I mean, this is really a demonstration of the quality of the calorimeter. Now, I can use a few mathematical equations. I won't go into that right now. If you're interested in the math, you can see me later on. But to use the temperature of the recombiner, I only need to know the temperature of the recombiner initially when no hydrogen was being recombined, and the temperature after all the hydrogen is being recombined, those two limits. That's all I need to know. And with that knowledge and this equation, I can calculate the fraction of hydrogen that is entering the palladium. And the result is shown here. This is the average P-to-P-D ratio. In this case, I'm using light hydrogen. It's cheaper, but it produces the same effect as a function of time. And this is the fraction reacted with the palladium as a function of time based upon that equation. And you can see that the composition follows the line that would predict 100% reacted based upon the applied current. It follows that very closely as we expected, and then it starts to deviate, and then finally it becomes constant at the maximum composition that this particular sample can obtain. And the fraction, you can see here, this is saying that roughly 90% reacts for quite a while, and then it starts dropping off, and finally zero reacts after it's fully reacted. I have three different independent methods for measuring this ratio. The temperature of the recombiner, which I just described. The orphaned oxygen technique relies on the fact that when hydrogen reacts with the sample, oxygen is left behind, so-called orphaned, and that oxygen pressure builds up, is communicated to the reservoir, the oil is displaced, I weigh the oil, from that I can calculate how much oxygen, how many moles of oxygen, and I can convert that to the number of moles of hydrogen, and thereby get, in real time, every minute, in fact, values for the for that ratio. Finally, after the sample has reached saturation, I can take it out and within 1 minute place it on a five-digit balance, watch the loss of hydrogen, extrapolate that back to zero time using the square root of time. And from that I can gain a value for the weight based upon the weight. Each of these are independent of one another, and when agreement occurs, that's a pretty good indication that we are in fact measuring reality. It's interesting though that this does not always match, and there are occasions when you get differences between the different measurements. Those reveal processes that are truly abnormal, and I don't have time to get them into them today, but what it says once again that every time you look at palladium, you see something weird. I mean, palladium are just one of those characteristics that we happen to be fond of, but there are other weird behaviors. Now, the enthalpy of formation can also be obtained from this because we know how much hydrogen is reacting, and we know the energy that that is resulted in producing using the calorimeter. But before I show you my data, I'd like you to see what the literature shows. There are three measurements reported in the literature for the enthalpy of formation as a function of composition. And this is done by placing finely divided palladium in a calorimeter. They will load it, deload it 10 times in order to activate the surface so that it loads very quickly. And then they will apply a known pressure, and that will result in a characteristic composition. And in that process, energy is given off, and they measure that energy and report it as enthalpy of formation. And so you can see when in the alpha phase, the enthalpy of formation is rather low. It's fairly constant in the two-phase region. And then it shows a slightly weird behavior in the single-phase beta phase, dropping down in this manner. This other curve is the pressure, and it shows the characteristic increase of pressure. Now we can compare the three measurements. This particular one is the straight line. The same researcher produced another, did it again with finely divided palladium rather than foil, got essentially the same result. Flanagan also used foil, but he reported his points so I could fit them with another equation. What we want is the slope. You see, this number here is the total that would result from adding hydrogen to pure palladium, resulting, let's say, in this composition. I would like to know what energy would result in going from here to here. In other words, the slope of this curve. And it's very interesting to note that that slope is negative. In other words, if this is a straight line, it means that once you enter that region of composition, the reaction with hydrogen is endothermic, it is not exothermic. In other words, energy is required to put hydrogen into the lattice. In other words, there's anti-bonding, there's rejection of the hydrogen taking place. If it's a straight line and it's a fixed number, in the case here, this can be fit by a quadratic, the slope goes from about 0.6 kilojoules per mole plus, this is exothermic, to 103 minus at the other composition. Anyway, so this is the literature, and these samples are in equilibrium, and so and they all agree very nicely. So the question is, how does that fit with what I see? This is the same measurement of these three different materials, each one loaded, and measurements made as a function of atomic ratio. And these are the data points shown in the previous slide. So you see that my data really is rather close to what's in the literature. However, the behavior of the alpha phase is quite different. I'm seeing a very large enthalpy of formation whereas they saw a very small one. Well, what could be the cause of that, other than just simply sloppy measurement and error? Let's do the same thing they did. Let's load and deload repeatedly. Now, we know that when that happens, weird things happen to Palladium. The volume expands, the shapes change, the basic characteristics change, and that's one of the problems that we have in this field, that if you load and look at, and then deload and reload again, you're not looking at the same sample. You're not looking at the same characteristics. You're not looking at the same properties. And so it's very difficult to reproduce a measurement because the sample nature keeps changing. And you can see the way it keeps changing, the enthalpy of formation of the alpha phase steadily drops as that process is imposed. The beta phase, not so much. So let's look at the slope. Let's look at essentially the bond energy that this represents. The original one was fairly high for the alpha phase, and the beta phase is not affected very much. But when you do many of these loadings and deloadings, this is after six of them, the enthalpy of formation of the alpha phase is reduced to that value which was measured by the other studies. So in other words, I can reproduce what's that? Coordinates? I can reproduce what they saw simply by loading and deloading. I can do that same thing by rolling. In other words, if I load and then make this measurement, deload, and then roll the sample so that it is half the thickness, nothing else has changed, I get this characteristic. So the distortion of the bonds that results from deloading, from rolling rather, and from deloading is similar. And you can see here the difference between the original sample and the rolled sample all manifests itself in the alpha phase. The beta phase is hardly affected at all. The important thing about the beta phase, however, is that it is exothermic initially, and then drops like the other data in the literature shows, but this shows more detail. The scatter here is because I make that measurement every minute. Every time I take a measurement, I get another independent value, so there's random scatter. But you can see the trend, and the trend shows that at some critical composition, the bonding becomes exothermic, or becomes endothermic, rather. It requires energy. Well, it's rather interesting that you can see another characteristic that has a relationship. This is the resistivity. And as you can see, the resistivity increases as you add hydrogen to the beta phase until a critical composition is reached, and then it starts dropping very rapidly. That composition corresponds very closely to where the bonding becomes endothermic. The explanation that I can offer is that the bonding in this region, which is exothermic, results from the electron that goes with the hydrogen going into the 5s level of the palladium, producing a bond, an attractive bond. But at this point, those states become saturated, and now the electron goes into the conduction band where it is non-bonding. And that non-bonding characteristic shows up as a negative energy, that is, requires energy to put it into that state. Now, all of this is very, very important to theory and understanding of LAMR. But unfortunately, I don't have time to go into that. It would take another hour or two, and don't bore most of you to death. But recognize that this does have a direct bearing on theory, and theoreticians need to take this into account. So So let's summarize very quickly. The addition of hydrogen to beta-palladium hydride above about 0.75 produces increased non-bonding between the palladium and the hydrogen as added electrons enter the conduction band rather than bonding orbits. The measurement of the recombiner temperature allows the ratio and the bond energy to be determined, and it's a trivial measurement. I mean, I didn't hit upon this until fairly recently, and I keep kicking myself because this is so easy now. The loading behavior shows important information about the loading mechanism, and so it's really worth following this loading in detail. And the bond energy gives information about the mechanism and how it might function. The stability of the alpha phase is very sensitive to purity and treatment, but the beta phase not so much. Now the role of the alpha phase in LANR is still somewhat ambiguous. Thank you very much.
I can take one or two questions.
I enjoyed your talk a lot, and I'm a fan. In the 1930s and 1940s, people measured resistance of alloys. And if you go from a pure to a mix to a pure to the other one, as a general trend, the resistance goes up and comes down. And in those days, the resistance curve for alloys was interpreted in terms of order. You're not interpreting the alloy for hydrogen palladium in terms of any order effects here.
That's true, I'm not. I'm relying on what I might call conventional chemistry in terms of the way in which the electrons are interacting. Now, order will certainly play a role in resistivity. I'm not denying that. But in this particular case, I think we can explain it without having to impose that particular aspect.
Dr. Storms, I thought you were going to talk about loading and deloading, and I made this visual aid for you.
Wow. All right, let me hear. See, if you give a talk about loading, this is what you get to do your work. And this will be a lot more comfortable to wear than what I'm wearing now. Thank you, Ruben.
Do you have an estimate for the rate of desorption?
Yes, I can measure that, and it is characteristic of the material. It has a rate over a range. Some samples don't deload at all. It's rather amazing. For example, the single crystal material. You load it up to 0.8, take it out, and it just simply sits there. It does not deload at all. Other samples will deload fairly rapidly, and if you leave them out very long, they'll almost go back. Well, they'll go back to about 0.6 and then stay there. But the deloading characteristic is really very, very important because that deloading is occurring during electrolysis as well. And that aspect of deloading you can't do anything about by altering the surface characteristics. So you want to try to avoid whatever mechanism is causing deloading normally out in the air. And that deloading is unaffected, by the way, whether it's an acetone or whether it's an electrolytic cell. It has the same characteristics and the same rates, so long as the electrolysis is not taking place.
Relative time scale, minutes, seconds, hours, days?
Well, it's very, let's see, the slope is such that it will be low, let's say if it's at 0.8 to start with, in 7 minutes, which is what the time I use, it'll go down to maybe about 0.75. It doesn't change a lot, but if you use a five-place balance, you can measure it for three significant figures and get a very good number.
Yeah, thank you.
Since time is over, I just take one short question.
Ed, thank you for that presentation. Do you think the change of slope in the enthalpy of formation of the palladium hydride is related to occupancy of the tetrahedral sites within the metal lattice?
No. I mean, technically helical sites can be occupied, and they certainly are occupied temporarily during diffusion. Whether they're there as a steady occupation, that would change the composition effectively, because there would be places where it could go other than where you expect it to go. And if you have that kind of occupancy, you would expect it to increase as you get closer and closer to the saturation limit, in which case the H to PV ratio should exceed 1. I have never seen it exceed 1. Also, people who use neutron diffraction and using deuterium can see it. And there's some evidence that there might be some minor occupancy, but I don't think it's a major characteristic of the material.
Thank you very much.